2012, January 9th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 5, The Chemical Revolution and the Nature of Matter. Well, last Friday, we started a section I'm calling Five Revolutions. We're trying to set the underlying intellectual basis for our exploration of life in the universe. In order for a question to be answered, first, sometimes that question must make sense to be asked. And with the Copernican Revolution, what we saw as the outcome of that was the Copernican Revolution actually answers the question, what is the place of the Earth, what is the place of us in the universe? What it did was open up space to become vast. It could, in fact, even be infinite, making the stars, other suns, and opening the possibility, although as yet no data to back up that possibility, that those other suns could have other worlds. So it actually makes the whole inquiry about life being somewhere else, first it has to have somewhere else to be. And in the Aristotelian view of the world, there was no place but the Earth. Today we're going to not look outwards, but we're going to look inwards. We're going to ask, what is the nature of matter, the stuff we are made of? And I've called this, for sake of argument for this course, the chemical revolution. It's our inquiry into the nature of what is matter, what is the stuff that we are made of. We're going to see that what this lecture is going to be about is looking about how this so-called chemical revolution really revealed what the nature of matter is. So we're going to start by just tracing the history of our ideas about what the nature of matter is and the slow recognition of the atomic theory, as we now call it. Again, once what we've seen before will also be the case here. A lot of advances come with advances in technique and technology. The ability to measure things is really what brings us forward. Big ideas are all well and good, but you've got to back those ideas up with numbers. And so there's some techniques that had to be developed, very accurate measurements, to really make progress forward on understanding the nature of matter and the nature of the chemical world. We're going to introduce the idea of the periodic table. This was originally designed as an organizing principle, a way of putting matter and ordering it by weight and its electronic bonding properties, but at a time before we actually understood the actual atomic nature of data. So often you can make a lot of, I'll use this as an illustration. Often we can make a lot of progress in a field even if we don't have full understanding of the underlying phenomenon itself, by finding order, by finding patterns in nature that sort of points the way forward. And ultimately, understanding those orderings and patterns often leads us to the correct description of what is actually going on physically within this. There was both the periodic table and then the science of spectroscopy, which is one of the most powerful tools of the astronomer, the chemist, the biologist, and the geologist. It's a way of revealing the nature of matter through its interaction with light. Spectroscopy was a powerful tool before we understood atomic theory and quantum mechanics. And finally, we were going to end up with the point that's a very surprising idea to many people at the time, but in fact is an outgrowth of the Copernican Revolution, namely that when we look deeply at the nature of matter and we start sampling what matter is like in space, what we discover is other worlds are made of the same stuff as we are. All the elements that make up the Earth and that make up life are in fact very common throughout the universe, and not surprisingly are among the most common elements that make up the entire universe. And that's going to be one of the important pieces we're going to be able to bring forward into our inquiry about the nature of life. Well, again, let's sort of go back and ask, well, what are our ancient notions about what is the nature of matter? What is the nature of the stuff we are surrounded with and the stuff we're made of ourselves? Not surprisingly, this almost inevitably leads us back to the ancient Greeks. You know, the primary touchstone of Western civilization really begins with Mediterranean civilization in kind of the 3rd or 4th century B.C. It's surprising how in that particular area, within a few centuries, most of the main questions had been framed, if not correctly answered. And once again, we're going to see that there are two schools of thought that have begun to emerge. Much like there was a heliocentric and geocentric view of the world for astronomy, so too in the nature of matter, there began to emerge two schools of thought. One of these, which emerged mostly in the Eastern Mediterranean, was a group that we'll nowadays call the atomists. In particular, there are two philosophers, Leucippus and his most famous student, Democritus. What they Their works are so closely intertwined, we really can't tell whether it was Leucippus or Democritus who actually had the idea, although we often credit it primarily to Democritus. To them, we put the idea is that elements, the matter, the stuff that we're made of, is actually composed of tiny, indivisible atoms. The word atom comes from the Greek word atom, meaning uncuttable. The idea was that you could sit there and grind a rock down into finer and finer degrees of powder. And Democritus and Leucippus asked, at what point does that stop? Can you continually subdivide having forever until you get infinitely small? Or is there a certain point where you get down to the smallest unit you can no longer cut in half? And what they proposed was simply the problem of sort of an infinite regress, of an infinite number of indivisibility, ultimately leads you into absurdity if you've got an infinite number of divisions. And so there must be a stopping point. And they decided that that stopping point was at some fundamental unit of matter, the fundamental uncuttable thing they called the atom. They went one step further on the basis of no evidence whatsoever than sort of a philosophical gut feeling that because they viewed the heavens as being made of the same stuff as the earth, it was also governed by the same physical laws. So the atomists went much further than simply proposing the idea of an indivisible final point, that the fundamental particle of nature. But they actually proposed that everything in the universe was made of these. And it was the interactions among those that formed the rule set for how nature behaved. This was a very bold leap in an almost complete absence of actual experimental data. But it was to lay one of the fundamental underpinnings of modern science. The other view was held by the Aristotelians, Aristotle and those who came after him. Aristotle seems to have had an opinion about everything. And he particularly had an opinion about the nature of matter. It was probably not original to Aristotle, but he was certainly the person who synthesized many of these ideas. And he came up with the idea that there are four elements, and only four elements, that make up the earth. The heavens, on the other hand, were composed of some ethereal matter, a fifth essence that was beyond the realm of the earth. And therefore, the heavens were made of different stuff than the earth. The heavens were the place of perfection, of unending, perfect circular motion, whereas the earth was the place of decay, death, and change. The four elements are, not surprisingly, earth, air, fire, and water, the sort of four fundamental forms in which we experience the material world. There's the air we breathe, the water that you can swim through or that falls from the sky. The earth is the dirt, the solid stuff we make out of. We make things out of, like bricks, or we hew stones from the earth. And finally, fire. Furthermore, there were clearly transformations among these. You take a solid bit of earth, a bit of wood, for example, which obviously is growing from the earth and therefore is of the earth. You light it on fire and you get smoke, which then disappears into the air. Smoke might go up. They perhaps thought of smoke forming clouds, and the clouds then rain back down as water. And so you can see all these transformations among these things. On the one hand, it looks like a kind of common sense view of the world, but on the other hand, it seems kind of limited. How is it that Earth is able to manifest itself in so many different forms? Pure rock crystals, a brown dirt, human beings, trees, plants, things like that. It left unanswered a lot of questions. But it was such a compelling idea that it actually held sway for a very, very long time. The atomists were largely ridiculed, in large measure because they had projected this idea of atoms being so small you couldn't see them. What's kind of the use of something you can't see? And so, if you will, the Aristotelians are kind of like the ultimate impractical. They only can understand those things you can reach out and grab. But that's also a very limiting point of view, and it can limit you for a long time. Now, in the Middle Ages, the Aristotelian view was really one of the ones that survived from antiquity and became the fundamental layer of knowledge in the Middle Ages leading up to the Renaissance. In the Middle Ages, however, the alchemists, those people who were kind of proto-chemists, they were working with matter and trying to understand its transformations, began to realize that the four elements of Aristotle were pretty limiting. They didn't really describe things. Just to bring up a couple of examples, one of the real fathers of chemistry, sort of one of the orfathers of chemistry in the 15th century, was an alchemist by the name of Paracelsus. It was Paracelsus who added to the classical five elements sulfur, mercury, and salt, because these seem to be different. Salts were precipitated out of water, for example. Mercury was a liquid metal. It obviously was just way different than anything else. And sulfur had this wonderful property that when you burned it, it flashed into this nasty-smelling smoke. And so it was pretty clearly there was just something different about them. And they began to recognize the differences of these properties. Later on, they began to see that certain specific metals had certain specific properties, like gold and silver and lead. And certainly from a long time, people realized that you could form compounds of some of these materials. For example, you might have copper and you might have tin. Copper itself is pretty nice metal, but it's pretty brittle. Tin is very malleable, and you can't really form very useful things. You couldn't, for example, make an axe or a sword blade out of tin, because if you wax someone, it'd kind of bend. But if you alloyed a bit of copper, which was brittle, or was soft tin, you got bronze. And bronze was a remarkable metal. You could melt it over and over again, recast it into swords, spear points, statuary. You could do all kinds of things with it. Until the coming of learning how to make iron. And especially when you notice that, gee, when you mixed iron with a bit of wood ash, which is actually incorporating carbon, you could get another form of iron called steel. You saw that there were changes in these states of matter. So the idea of compounding really came primarily out of metallurgy. And it was this idea of making compounds. They couldn't really recognize what was going on down at the atomic level, but they began to see that the different properties that different materials had, maybe a shininess, maybe its liquidness, maybe the ability to dissolve in water like salts, that often you could see that there were occasional transformations of one state into another. And this whole idea began to grow up that maybe you could, in fact, transform one whole element into another. Maybe these elements weren't indivisible. Maybe they were actually transmutable. This idea of transmutation was very important. So on the one hand, you kind of have the atomist point of view, which says that ultimately you get down to an indivisible atom. You can't turn it from one thing into another. It is what it is. It's a fundamental unit, a fundamental thing, a fundamental entity. Whereas the elements of Aristotle seemed more mutable. They seemed to change from one into another. And perhaps there was seeking to change, you know, the old legend is the alchemists sought to change lead into gold. That's sort of a popular level look view of these things, the philosopher's stone, kind of the foolish level. But what the alchemists were really trying to do was they were trying to understand these different transmutations among different forms and perhaps in the process find useful forms. They were really proto-chemists. There's more relationship between the alchemists and the modern chemists than there is between the astrologer and the astronomer. There was actually a practical aspect that came out of this. Alchemy sort of has a bad stink on it now, literally or figuratively, but you've got to remember that in the 16th and 17th centuries, some of the greatest scientists also dabbled in alchemy. Isaac Newton, for example, who we now know as the father of gravitation and modern physics, actually spent more of his years working in alchemy than he did actually on the physics and calculus. It was a fascinating series of problems. But the problem was all of this qualitative work of mixing and matching things together was really hard to get on a firm quantitative basis. It really required a change in technology and a change in approach to really begin to make much progress. People could identify individual elements. The alchemists were able to begin to identify certain compounds which always seemed to be an end precipitate or an end product of melting. So these things seemed to be fundamental. And the table of elements began to grow tremendously. But to try to really understand, well, what is it that made gold different from silver, different from lead, than its apparent outward properties, was still somewhat elusive. So we jump forward now from this Middle Ages from alchemy, and we come forward into the 18th century, and we meet one of the real fathers of modern chemistry, the Frenchman Antoine Lavoisier. He was really the first quantitative chemist. He grew up in this post-Newtonian world where people were beginning to understand the laws of motion in terms of mathematical descriptions, and it was Lavoisier who began to develop new techniques for measuring chemical changes, what we now recognize as chemical changes. The first thing he did was actually make a series of measurements where he found and greatly extended the number of chemical elements that were clearly distinct in terms of their properties, eventually describing 33 distinct chemical elements, including hydrogen and oxygen. Now, he was not the discoverer of these elements, but he came up with a self-consistent description of these things. Furthermore, he was able to, through a series of beautiful and elegant experiments, show that these 33 elements were immutable, that you could not change hydrogen into oxygen into something else, at least certainly by the means that he possessed. Once you sort of broke a material down into its component parts, you could do things like break water, and you ended up with hydrogen and oxygen. There was nothing further to break it into. But he did so not merely with pure thought, but with a series of beautiful, elegant, quantitative experiments. He could actually put numbers upon the weights and the properties of these, and he really gave birth to modern chemistry through this process. It was an amazing feat. It was almost single-handed in many of its ways. Lots of people were working in this area, but Lavoisier did was twofold. The first was to develop wonderful new techniques, and the second was he had a very keen, incisive mind and was be able to take all of these different activities and synthesize them together and see the underlying patterns. We don't know how far Antoine Lavoisier would have gotten with this work because he was also a member of the French nobility. He was one of the farmers general. That doesn't mean he actually farms and grows things. The farmers general, for those of you who know something about French politics of the 18th century, were the primary tax collectors for the crown. When the French Revolution came around, the tax collectors were among the most hated people. Think of the Tea Party, but actually armed and dangerous rather than just simply loud. As a consequence, when the terror hit, Lavoisier was one of the victims and he died on the guillotine. He was cut short, and his life was very short, in fact, as you can see from doing the math up there. He was barely in his 51st year. But he left behind a tradition of extremely accurate experimentation. These are some of Lavoisier's experimental apparatuses. It primarily consists of extremely high precision scales. As you would do a chemical experiment, you would see the changes in the weights of things as the chemical reactions as came and went. You could do them under heat, you could do them under cold, you could do them contained in glass vessels. He was an extremely clever experimentalist and set the stage for a lot of the chemistry that was to come in the 17th century, in the 18th and later 19th centuries. So what were people to make of Lavoisier's elements? Well, there's a lot of different people working on this, but the next person who really brought it forward was a man by the name of John Dalton. Dalton lived in between the 18th and 19th centuries, living until 1844. He basically revived the old Democritean atomic theory and said that this sort of indivisibility, this immutability of the elements was a reflection of a deep underlying, and he felt, deeply microscopic structure of matter. That each chemical element was composed of atoms, things which could not be broken down, that were each of a single unique type, and that the differences among these elements really represented fundamentally different atoms. They cannot be changed, and they cannot be destroyed by chemical means. Now, he still left open the possibility that there may be other means to change the elements, but he had no idea what that was. Furthermore, all of the various chemical compounds and structures we see around us are themselves basically combinations of these elements. You simply took different atoms and put them together, and they form new compounds with new properties. Now, what he didn't understand, first of all, but he began to see patterns, was you could not simply make arbitrary compounds. The compounds seemed to come with certain patterns to them. For example, you might take carbon and combine it with hydrogen. You always ended up with something whose weight was equivalent to a single carbon with four hydrogens. You never got a carbon with three hydrogens, or carbon with two, or carbon with six. It was always carbon and four. The others didn't exist. So he was beginning to see in the rules that govern the formation of compounds, there was some other rule at play, which governed which were permissible and which were not permissible compounds of atoms. He didn't understand it, but he began to catalog it. And again, developed a series of very elegant experiments. This picture over here on the right is showing the elements of Dalton. In fact, in this particular case, he's got this very elaborate symbology, which I won't try to unpack here, of the various shapes here. For example, hydrogen here is the symbol for the sun and so forth. And he's assigned them a number 1 through 20. And then he's shown that you can form various binary compounds, ternary compounds, compounds of 3, 4, 5, and 6, and so forth. And you could see these. You could basically describe all of the different chemicals that people were using and discovering and synthesizing could ultimately be described as various compounds of these individual atoms. And he began the process of being able to catalog these and understand how they all work together. But people began to see was that patterns began to emerge. And the question was, what were those patterns? What were the rules behind those patterns? And what do those rules and patterns tell us about the underlying nature of matter? This was an amazing piece of insight beginning to emerge here. Because these atoms are far smaller than human sight can actually allow anyone, even with the technology of this time, even with the technology of the 21st century, it's difficult to see an individual atom. And then what we mean by see is actually a fairly nuanced. We actually can't see them with light per se. So we know that these are extremely small things, and yet their properties are reflecting that microscopic invisible structure. So it was this realization that if you can understand the rules behind how compounds are formed, how atoms behave, you can actually begin to understand structures far smaller than you can probe directly by literally looking at them. And it was this seeking after patterns that motivated the next major advance. It came from a number of directions, but really the culmination of this was a Russian, this gentleman over here on the right, Dmitry Mendeleev. Mendeleev worked from sort of the middle 19th century up to the beginning of the 20th century. And he was also engaged in this process of trying to understand these patterns that were discovered among the elements. There were patterns in their weight. Why were some atoms heavier than others? But you never found, for example, that two atoms of completely different types, two different elements, never had the same weight. Right? One was always of distinct weight. Gold was distinct from silver, was distinct from carbon, was distinct from hydrogen and oxygen. You never had, you know, element one and element two having the same or very nearly the same weight. They were always very distinctive. That was one important clue as to what was going on. The second important clue was those that were found by the chemists is that you could only form certain kinds of compounds. You could not form arbitrary assemblages of atoms. Only certain patterns seemed to be allowed. So they got this idea of one kind of element bonding with another. And there were rules governing those bondings. For example, I mentioned that a single carbon atom could bond with four hydrogens, but never form a stable compound of three or two or six. It was always four. So what Mendeleev and others began to work through were the differences of these arrangements. Now, by the year 1869, chemists had identified 67 distinct elements and were discovering more every year. He noted they had differences of weight, and they had differences of bonding type. And he began to note that there were repeatable patterns among these. And he formed an actual table, a two-dimensional table, in which he ordered atoms by their weight and by various types of bonding properties that were in common. So, for example, to name one, he noted, for example, that carbon and silicon, two very different elements in weight, two very different elements in their appearance. Carbon, a black solid, silicon, a clear crystalline material, nonetheless followed similar bonding rules. Silicon only formed four bonds, just like carbon, even though they were vastly different weight. He found, for example, that sulfur and arsenic had very similar phosphorus and arsenic had very similar bonding properties, even though they were vastly different in their other manifestations. And so he began to note that there was a two-dimensional arrangement of these things. And what he was beginning to see was that it mattered not only what the weight of the atom was, but there was something about the atom that set how it bonded to other atoms. He didn't know what it was, but he saw the fundamental pattern. What he noted also was when he filled out his table, I'll take the table out of the way because this isn't very enlightening, was that there were gaps in the table. There were places where there was no known element to fill in the hole in the table. Now, most people would have just thrown their hands up and said, there's just nothing there. Mendeleev, however, had the key insight that maybe there is, in fact, something there. And so he did something that no one had ever done before. He predicted the existence of previously unknown chemical elements. In particular, two of those gaps turned out to be gallium and germanium, the new elements that were discovered by chemists when they began to go looking for things which had similar chemical properties to their items in the one column, but a certain higher weight. So now we're seeing, without any understanding of atomic theory, without any understanding of electrons circling atoms and bonding, by finding these detailed patterns among matter, we were able to actually begin to predict the existence of new forms of matter. This had an electrifying effect on chemistry. It was starting to show the pathway to the understanding of the nature of matter. Well, jump ahead to the 21st century. We now know of literally hundreds of elements. This is the periodic table of the elements. Anyone who's ever taken a chemistry class will recognize this. This is on every chemistry lab wall. This shows a series of arrangements of atoms, starting with the lightest atom, hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, and so forth, up to the various heaviest elements out here. Well, lawrencium is, in fact, that one down there in the corner. So there's a general arrangement. As you go through each element gets progressively heavier than the one that came before it. Furthermore, all the elements lying in a particular vertical line all share similar chemical bonding properties. So, for example, carbon, silicon, and germanium, tin, lead, and element 114, which now has a name, but I forget what it is, all have very similar chemical properties. But those are distinct from nitrogen, which shares chemical properties with phosphorus, arsenic, SB? Antimon, very good, and bismuth, for example, and so on down the line. And then there's these group of elements here, helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, radon, and unknown 118, don't form chemical bonds with anything. So all of these have detailed patterns. Something is linking them together. They have different weights, but there are repeating patterns which tell you something about the underlying structure of the atom. What is that structure? Well, this is only one piece of the clue. The second piece also required on a technological advance and a recognition of a physical phenomenon related to atomic structure, and that is the idea of spectroscopy. Spectroscopy is basically a technique for sorting light from a source into its component colors. So, for example, the most common source of spectroscopy is you take a glass prism and you pass white light through the prism. And different index of refraction through the prism. You get less refraction from red, more refraction from blue. When you fan these out, at the other end of the prism, you see that the white light is broken into component colors from red through violet. Now, this was noted for a long time. People have been playing with prisms for years. Isaac Newton wrote the definitive treatise on optics, trying to understand that white light was actually a compound of individual colors. It was treated as a curiosity on the one hand, but perhaps telling us something fundamental about light on the other. And there are various ways in which you could construct an apparatus to make a spectrum. Chemists started asking the question, when you burn certain compounds, so you'd make sort of a salt. For example, you'd make a salt of boron, and you get kind of a white, sort of translucent sort of salt precipitate, and you dip a stick in water and you'd coat it with these borate crystals. And then you would put it in a gas flame and burn it. And all of a sudden, the flame would burn a bright green. Or different other elements, like rubidium and others, would have like a bright red flame. Or different or bright orange flame, for example, if you made salt, sodium chloride salt, and put that on a stick and put that in a flame, it was sort of a bright orange yellow. So different compounds burned with different colors. And so they quickly became curious. They built spectrographs, these devices for sorting light into component colors, and actually began to sort the light into colors. This was done by a number of people, Fraunhofer and others, and what they found was really a quite remarkable thing. They found when they looked at the spectra of individual atoms, of individual elements, those elements not only had distinctive chemical properties, they had distinctive spectral signatures. Now what you see when you burn a pure sample of an element like hydrogen or helium, oxygen, neon, or iron. I've just chosen those, but it could be anything, boron, silicon. What you get is instead of seeing this perfect rainbow wash of continuous color, you see only certain very, very bright lines, certain very particular discrete colors. So, for example, hydrogen, you see a bright red, sort of a light blue-green, blue, and deeper blue. But when you have neon, you have a whole bunch of red, orange, yellow, green, and blue lines. And these are called lines because of the way the spectrograph worked, would smear the light out into what's called a slit, and so you could basically get a discrimination in the horizontal direction by wavelength. So you get blue wavelengths to red wavelengths. It's like a rainbow that's interrupted. But neon always looked the same, or oxygen always looked the same when you burned it. When you burned a borate compound, that green appearance of the flame was reflected by very, very strong green lines. And only boron showed those particular green lines. So this was a remarkable tool. Because if you could catalog all the known elements, and you take, unknown gray crud in a jar, put a little bit on a stick, put it into a gas flame, light it up, and then look at the spectrograph, you might say, aha, there's the lines of strontium, there's the lines of oxygen, there's the lines of... And you could take apart the material by looking at how it produced light. So spectroscopy began as a chemical tool. And it was an extremely powerful tool because every now and then you would make a sample, say, from crushing down some rock, and you might find a pattern of lines you've never seen before. You found a new element. So it became another and extremely definitive way to identify new elements. Now, it turns out that two of the people who really pioneered this were two chemists, Kirchhoff and Bunsen. And I forget which one of these two guys is Kirchhoff and which one is Bunsen. Kirchhoff was the person who really developed good spectroscopic techniques. He also developed certain laws we now refer to as Kirchhoff's laws for describing spectra. Again, he didn't understand atomic theory at that point, but he began to see the underlying patterns. Bunsen was really good at developing natural gas flame tools. The Bunsen burner. That's Bunsen. I think he's the guy over here on the left. So, for example, Kirchhoff and Bunsen working together discovered the elements cesium and rubidium using an apparatus very much like the sketch in the upper right-hand corner. So not only could you use this to look at to take apart compounds into known elements, you could use them to discover entirely new elements altogether. And so it opened up a completely new realm. The thing was, no one understood exactly how it worked. Why was it that atoms had a distinctive signature from one to another? They just exploited that fact to move forward, while other people kept scratching their heads and saying, why does hydrogen have that pattern and only that pattern? The other thing that occurred with using spectroscopy was, of course, there are lots of points of light in the sky, the sun, the stars. People began to build telescopes and spectrographs which are of sufficient precision and sensitivity that you could turn them on the sky. And in fact, a man by the name of Fraunhofer and others immediately began to taking spectra of the sun and found that the sun was a continuous rainbow wash of color crossed by certain black lines. One of Kirchhoff's laws was that you could make bright lines if you made a hot gas. You would see dark lines if you viewed viewed a hot background continuous source, like a hot iron, through a cold gas of a compound, you would see this opposite pattern of dark lines. When people did that for the sun, they saw all the things we see on Earth. They saw hydrogen and helium and silicon, hydrogen and silicon, things like that. But one very strong line was of an element they didn't know. And so they called it the sun's element. The Greek word for the sun is helios. And this unknown element was called helium. It wasn't until the year 1895 that people actually identified a terrestrial source of helium when someone managed to capture what was called well gas. It was a thin, colorless, odorless, very, very lightweight gas that would bubble out of, among other things, oil wells and deep water wells. People finally captured it, managed to get enough of it in a jar to heat it up and make it glow. It had the emission line spectrum of the mystery sun element, and hence helium was actually discovered in the sun before it was discovered on Earth. It's the second lightest of the elements. Here, in fact, is a spectrum of the sun, a continuous rainbow wash of color, and now we've kind of folded it and wrapped it so it will fit in the slide. These dark lines here are identifiable with lines of hydrogen on Earth. These are lines of sodium in the yellow. These are lines of magnesium. And this little faint line here is that mystery line of helium. Almost all these other lines are lines like iron and calcium and other things. It was a tremendous discovery. The sun appeared to be made of the same materials as the stuff on the Earth. It was one thing to assert that the sun must be of the same material as the Earth. But spectroscopy actually demonstrated it. You could look at the spectra of the sun, and you could recognize the pattern of elements that you saw in terrestrial chemical samples in a star. And in fact, as telescopes and spectroscopes got bigger, they began to find the respector of other stars. Now, I didn't put this one in your notes because it's kind of a mess to do in black and white, but in fact, you can see patternings of lines in various stars. These stars are sorted by differences of temperature and slight differences of composition, but still, as we look at the stars, we find that the stars all through the sky are like the sun and like the Earth. They're made of the same materials we find here chemically on the Earth. In fact, if we do a full assay of the universe, this is kind of a tough game, but we do an assay of the chemical contents of the universe, we can arrange the top 8 most abundant elements in the universe. And what we find, they are, in order, hydrogen and helium, which together make up like 99% of all the elements in the universe, followed by oxygen, carbon, neon, nitrogen, silicon, and iron. So that's the top 8. And I've shown them here on the periodic table. They are, with the exception of iron, fairly light elements, hydrogen, helium, this whole row of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, not a whole lot of fluorine, you jump ahead to neon, silicon, and iron. This is really interesting. As we're going to see when we talk about the chemistry of life, the primary elements for the chemistry of life are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. If you look inside the body of the Earth itself, the primary elements we find on the Earth are iron, oxygen, and silicon. Every single one of these primary elements is among the top 8 in the universe. The only ones missing from here are helium and neon. And the reasons they're missing is they don't chemically react with anything. They don't form compounds. So they're abundant for reasons which we won't go into in this class. It actually has to do more with understanding the physics of stars. But it's interesting that among the top 8 most abundant elements, we find those most important for life and those which actually make up planets. So not only are these elements found everywhere in the universe, but the ones that are the most important are also among the most abundant. These are important clues that are going to help us when we start asking the question about what we should be looking for life elsewhere in the universe. So how do these atoms actually work? How do these patternings of chemicals and bonds actually work? Well, the fast version of it is, atoms are basically composed of a nucleus of protons and neutrons, which are orbited by electrons. So I've made kind of my cheesy model here. Here's hydrogen, the simplest atom. It's a single proton surrounded by a single electron. It's the lightest, most indivisible form of matter there is. Since it is the simplest atom, it is not surprisingly the most abundant. It's the easiest thing for the universe to make. Just have an electron find a proton, hey presto, you got hydrogen. Helium, the next up, is 2 protons plus 2 neutrons surrounded by 2 electrons. The atom itself is really mostly empty space. This is one of the surprising things. Democritus actually had twigged to this at some point, but now we can actually measure it. And what we find is that space, even in the most solid-seeming thing, is only 1 part in 10 to the 15 actually occupied by atomic material. This table seems awfully solid, but in fact, it's mostly empty space. Only 1 part in 10 to the 15 of this table actually has stuff in it. So if it's so empty, why is it when I slap my hand down, my hand doesn't just pass right through it? And the answer is because that space actually isn't empty. It's not filled with matter. It's filled with a field of energy, that field of electromagnetic energy, that is the force that binds one atom to another atom. So one of the mysteries of the structure of matter is these electrons here. They're the carriers of the electromagnetic force, and they actually bind one atom to another atom, either into tight compounds or those compounds into larger structures called, you know, solid material. If you break the bonds between those atoms, my hand can pass very easily through the air because it's displacing the air around it. There's no hard structure for it to run into. The atoms are far apart. The electromagnetic bonds between them are exceedingly weak. A liquid is kind of partway between. Now, let's look in more carefully at the distinction between the different atoms. These distinctions among the elements, they noted 2 things about them. One is that every element had a unique mass. The second was it showed a common set of bonding properties. Let's look at that mass difference. The difference in mass, the difference of sorting of atoms among atoms, is called the atomic number of the element. The atomic number is simply the count of the number of protons. So hydrogen is the simplest atom with one proton. It has an atomic number of 1. Helium has 2 protons, atomic number of 2. Lithium has 3 protons, atomic number of 3. Now, protons together have a positive charge and would want to tear that nucleus apart, so you add neutrons as a way of stabilizing it. The proton has a positive charge. An electron is a lightweight particle with a single negative charge of exactly the same strength, just different sign. So in order to make the atom electrically neutral, I add 1 electron for every proton. Now, the electrons are the carriers of the electromagnetic force, which are the bonding force between atoms. So this means that the number of electrons you have exactly scales like the size of the nucleus, which is given to a first approximation by the number of protons, and you just throw some neutrons in there to stabilize it. So this is the first hint. The differences of bonding properties and differences of weight is reflecting differences of structure of the atom itself. Now let's take a little closer look at one of these atoms and say, well, if I've got 3 protons, but I have 4 neutrons here, in helium I've got 2, how do you pick that number? How does that come up? It turns out that each element can have different forms, lighter or heavier forms, called isotopes, which is based by the differences of the number of neutrons. So for example, let's pick carbon. This is a very common element that we're going to deal with a lot. The most common form of carbon is called 12-carbon. It has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. 6 plus 6 is 12, hence the number. 6 protons says I'm carbon. So I can have 6 protons and 7 neutrons. It's still chemically carbon. It has 6 electrons surrounding a nucleus containing 6 protons. But this is a slightly heavier form of carbon because it now has 7 neutrons instead of 6. 6 and 7 is 13. So I put this little 13 in the upper left-hand corner to distinguish it. I can add another neutron. I can just keep going. I add 8 neutrons. 8 and 6 is 14. I end up with carbon 14. Again, 6 protons says I'm carbon, but I'm now heavier carbon. So there's carbon, heavy carbon, and heavier carbon. Well, words are kind of bad, so we can say carbon 12, carbon 13, carbon 14. Now, all of the isotopes of a given element are chemically identical because they carry the same number of electrons. And it's the exchange of electrons that gives them their chemistry. So whether I have carbon 13, I can form CO2, carbon and 2 oxygen, from carbon 12, from carbon 13, and from carbon 14. I can form methane and complex organic compounds containing carbon from any of these isotopic forms. They only differ by their atomic masses. But there's one other difference. I can't just keep piling neutrons on indefinitely. If I have too few or too many neutrons, the nucleus actually becomes unstable and comes apart. And now, the atomists didn't have it quite correct. Matter can transmute from one form to another through the process of radioactivity. So for example, hydrogen is a proton that says I'm hydrogen, but I pile 2 neutrons on. That's 1 neutron too many, and within a few minutes, it will decay into helium-3. One of the neutrons will turn into a proton and spit off a couple of fundamental particles just to keep the balance of charge and spin going right. Carbon-14, 6 protons and 8 neutrons, is unstable and will decay into 14 nitrogen, 7 one of the neutrons turns into a proton, 7 protons says, I'm nitrogen, next element over on the table, and then spits off some subatomic particles here. This is the basis of radiocarbon dating. Carbon 14 forms a carbon compound like everything else, but the carbon eventually turns into nitrogen. Free neutrons are also unstable. This radioactivity is characterized by something we call the half-life. It's the time for half of the atoms in a sample to decay into another form. So for example, this hydrogen 3 to 3 helium, half of the atoms will be gone in 12 and a quarter years. Carbon 14 and nitrogen 14, 5,730 years. And a free neutron will decay in about 12 minutes. This half-life is very important because if I can measure the products of the radioactive decay, I can actually measure how old that sample is from its original pure form. I'll give one example of a half-life decay process. atoms are kind of dangerous. Let's deal with something a little bit more elemental, beer. A beer foam is a good example of a half-life process. The collapse of a stiff foam, in fact, goes exponentially, such that, for example, let's take Erdinger dark beer. It starts out with a nice big head of foam of about 17 centimeters height. If I ask how long does it take until that foam is half the height, it takes about 192 seconds. If I wait another 192 seconds, I get half again as much. So it's a halving process. So we call it the half-life. It basically gives me the way in which the atoms decay from one form into another, just like the collapse of a beer foam. So, for example, this half-life is going to be very important to us as we talk about geology. So as the spectroscopy of stars and planets, the idea of the chemical elements, has revealed to us an interesting fact. The planets and stars are made of the very same elements on Earth, and those elements that we find out there are in the same abundances as they are on Earth to a first approximation. The basic elements of life and the basic composition of planets are among the most abundant elements in the universe. So this is giving us a very important piece of information. It says that chemistry, which may seem as remote from astronomy as it can possibly get, the chemistry lessons we learn on Earth are going to apply out in the heavens. Which means if we study chemistry and the chemistry of life on Earth, it gives us information about the possible nature of life on other planets. Questions? Okay, that's it. Thank you.